and wear it just to get a make sure it's working and get a level. Okay, fire away.
My name is W. Otis Wallace, Waitsfield, Vermont.
Perfect. Well, why don't we start with where you were born and some of your early memories.
Well, I was born right here in this house in Waitsfield, and it's been in the family since 1865. And my grandfather bought it years ago, and my father was born here, and all my brothers and myself were born here. And of course, years ago, my great, well, I don't know how many greats, Jonathan Wallace was the one that come over the mountain here in Waitsfield, the old Northfield-Waitsfield Road, which is already gone now. And he built a log cabin, he and Black Sam. A little history with a Black Sam. And years ago, my grandfather's, I guess probably would be the five greats grandfathers, showed up in Woodstock, Connecticut in 1728 with four slaves. We never could go back. We never knew where he did come from, but we kind of figured he'd come from down south. And they were blacksmiths. And David Wallace, who was the one that come, in Woodstock, Connecticut, and he married Mary Anderson, and they had five children, and the one, the branch we come from, was Jonathan Wallace. And then they moved from Woodstock, Connecticut, up to what was Brimfield. Later on, that was subdivided into two towns, which really they were located in Holland, Massachusetts. They lived there. He was quite important. He was a select man. He did a lot of community work there. And then later he branched off and come up to Wethersfield, Vermont, which was right on the Connecticut. In Wethersfield, they lived about 13 or 14 years. And then he come here to Waitsfield around 1802. And with him, he brought Black Sam, and they built a log cabin.
This was David Wallace.
No, this is Jonathan Wallace. And then after a few years, they built a house. In fact, I could take you right to the cellar hole where the house is. And they lived there, and his son, which was Joseph Wallace, lived there. And then Joseph Wallace had some sons. One of them was Otis Wallace, and which I'm named after. He owned the, come down and bought what was Everett Palmer's place. And they lived there for a short time, and then they moved here to my place, and they bought this in 1865. And that's a little history of the family.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Black Sam lived to 98, and I think down there in Holland, Massachusetts, they said he lived to 102. But he's buried up here in the corner of the common cemetery. Of course, those days, blacks weren't considered too much, so they kind of moved him off in one corner. Yeah, of course, when he come to Vermont, he had to give him his freedom. But Black Sam wouldn't leave him. Probably he was too old anyway to go out on his own. And so we've lived here, the family, for three generations. And I've got a niece that's now is thinking wants to keep the old place in the family. So we're negotiating now on some deals here at this place. My early days, I can remember when the grass used to grow up here in the road on Route 100. in the center of the road. And of course, those days, nobody had very much money, but they were always self-sufficient because they raised the gardens and they had their pigs and they had the cattle and, you know, the hens and so on and so forth, and the maple syrup. And of course, years ago, they used to, that was their sugar that they had. They didn't have white sugar back in those days. And the reason they had, how they made their sugar was usually they took the maple syrup, did it down, and put it into a big container, and then they would go to work, and after it hardened in a few days, then they would turn it bottom side up into a pan and let the molasses drain out of the sugar. And whatever was left, the residual, was pounded up and granulated. And I'll tell you, that syrup that comes from that, it was beautiful molasses. And those days we had a lot of snow. And in fact, I remember my father telling me about one time that they had so much snow one winter that when they come for sugaring, they had oxen. And it took them all day to get the road built from the house to the sugar house, because it was so drifted and so much snow and crusty. They, what they did, would take one ox and make a path, and then they'd take another ox and make the other path and wallow through it till they get up to the sugar house.
And the sugar house was?
Way up and back. So when they come to tap, of course, my father tapped as low as we could on the trees, but when it come after snow left, they could hardly reach the buckets because they were so high up. For myself, I went down here to the little one-room schoolhouse down here, what was called the North School, which was about a mile below me here. And I used to walk to school, all kinds of weather. I was there in the first two grades, my first and second. And then the third year, I went up here to the village. That was when they consolidated all the little one-room schoolhouses into one. And that, also, that was the time when the well, they had the four-year high school. It used to be a two-year high. And the junior and senior year, you had to go somewhere else, like to, out to Goddard or to Montpelier Seminary. Two of my brothers, one went to Goddard, one went to the Montpelier Seminary. And my other brother, Clifford, and I graduated from the high school up here. Those early days were hard days, but on the other hand, they were wonderful days too. Of course, everybody had horse and buggies and sleighs. Cars, if anybody had a car, they always put it up in the fall because they couldn't run it in the wintertime because the roads weren't plowed. And I can remember the when they used to come down with the roads, they used to have these huge rollers, snow rollers, and that would just pack the snow down. And of course, if it was a drift, the roller went over the drift. So I can remember up here on the hill, one year there was something like 36 cradle holes. Now, probably some people don't understand what a cradle hole is. Well, a cradle hole is usually where the roller would go over the drift, and then there would be a pocket down underneath. And as people traveled with their sleighs, they'd go over the hump, and then they'd go over, and then a little later it would form another one. And I can remember there was 36 cradle holes here from my house up to the top of the hill. And what you would do is just go into one and then up like this. It was rather amusing.
sort of like a ginormous washboard.
That's right. That's right. And of course, all the those days, the sleighs, the horse was offset on the left side, because wherever they, when they turned out, well, the horse had a path to go in, and the other horse, if they met them, would have the path on the other side. Then they'd all go back in. as I said, those days were hard in many respects, but really wonderful. Most everybody was in the same category. As far as finances was concerned, as I said, there wasn't much money to play around with. This probably was one reason, like when in the Depression of 27, or 29, rather, most of the people had plenty of food around here. And I can remember at that time, many people would be walking the road, men would be walking the roads to get, you know, for try to find a job. And those days, you could hire somebody for a week for $1 a week plus tobacco and board. I can remember my mother making sandwiches and things like that and setting them out here on the porch where these people could have something to eat. The times were very, very difficult. If you think you're in a depression now, you don't know anything about what a depression is like. I think most of the cities were the ones that were hit the hardest. And then, of course, when Roosevelt became president, he immediately put in the CCCs, and that's how all of our dams, a lot of the dams were built here, conservation dams, and like the Watanova Waterbury with a little river project. And then there was the WPA, which people worked for the WPA on the roads and doing that sort of thing. And the government paid them for that. That brought in, of course, a lot of employment, which helped a great deal. Until then, of course, later on the war came. I bought this place around 1936 from my father. The first 2 years was very, very difficult. My father, of course, had a lot of interest, public interest. He worked for the town. He was on the school board. In fact, he was the one that initiated the high school up here. Also, he was quite prominent in the milk business and co-ops and that sort of thing. I remember the first 2 years I had a very difficult time. I graduated from the Agri School over here at Randolph, and I spent 1 year at the University of Vermont. And my father put my other three boys through college, but when I come along, he told me, he says, I haven't got any money, so he says, you've got to borrow the money if you want to continue your education. Well, I didn't feel as if I wanted to go out and borrow the money under the circumstances at that time. So I went to work for my father for 4 years before I took over the farm in 1936. And the dairy was not very good. I had a lot of old horse-drawn equipment. And the pair of horses we had were long years. And then I went.
How many cows did you have?
Well, I used to, at that time, probably around 25. Then I increased it up to about 35 milkers. Pardon me.
All, of course, milked by hand.
Sometimes we milked by hand, but mostly with machine.
You did.
We had an old, what we call an old Empire machine. And after we increased the dairy, why we had to, pardon me if I put something in my...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, my throat's getting kind of dry.
We could stop at any point.
Well, you better stop right now. Otis Wallace sold the place up there to Everett Palmer's grandfather.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's how that happened to be. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the other thing, before I go, I should ask you who you recommend me to send to.
Well, let's see. I was trying to think of some other things here.
Well, you were saying when you took over the farm, how it was with, you had a herd of 30 cows or so.
About 25.
25. And you said the dairy was not in great shape.
No, that's right. And, I took it over 1936, and about, 2 years, I run in the hole financially, not very much. And when it comes to the third year, I told my father, I said, you better take the farm back, and I'll go out. In fact, I had a job offered me, which was very good pay over in New York, and I wanted to go over and take the job, and I told him, I'll pay off the bills. And he says, I'm too old. He says, I just can't run the farm. So he says, I wish you'd stay on one more year. So I did, and I broke even that year. And then, of course, World War II broke out, and then things got better. I had a little experience there because I had got within 12 hours of my private pilot license. And, of course, I had been in the ROTC up there at the university. Well, of course, they kept deferring me till finally they put me into 1A. In the meantime, my father was on the rationing board and working for the government there. I mean, he didn't get any money out of it, but everybody put in, their effort. And so they put me into 1A, and my father challenged it. And first thing I know, one day there was an FBI man showed up here, and he sat right over there in the chair that you're sitting in, and I never got such a Scotch blessing from him, from anybody, like I did from him. And he told me, he says, you're not any better than anybody else. And I says, that is correct. But when he got through, I told him, I says, if I go in the Army and I'm going to be drafted, I'm going to sell all the cattle. I'm going to sell everything here because I'm not going to ask my father to run it at the age of 74. I says, he can't do it because there's no help and that sort of thing. So I says, this is just, in other words, I said, the production of the farm is going out. In the meantime, I had built it up quite a bit. And he finally sat there in the chair and he thought about it. Well, he says, Mr. Wallace, he says, somebody's got to raise food for the Army. So he says, I think it'd be more important for you to stay here. And so that's how I never got into the World War II. And that was a little experience here. And then after he left here, he went out and he sat about two hours out here in his car making out papers and so on and so forth. And immediately after that, I was put into 1F, which that's how it comes, how I didn't get into World War II. So, and then of course I was married in 1943 to Elsie Tryon Wallace. And I got acquainted with her back in 1933. She taught school up here in home economics for a year and a half. And then she went from there and went to Middlebury and taught in Middlebury for 9 years. And in the meantime, I'd go over and see her once in a while. And finally we ended up getting married in 1943. So my wife has lived here since. I think it was kind of hard for her at first because she wasn't used to farm life. And but after a year or two, she got acquainted to it. And I don't think she's ever regretted it. And I farmed it right up till 1968, which I was beginning to have a lot of back trouble. And the doctor told me I just got to get off of milking cows and also the tractors because it was injuring my back. So So I had to quit farming at that time. And I went into some other things too. In the meantime, I'd been a director of several cooperative creameries. Over here at one is Mount Mansfield, it used to be in Waterbury. And then they united with the co-op in Stowe, and I was a director at that. And then I was a director of the Barry Co-op out there to Barry, which made real ice cream for several years. I've been a director of the insurance company, the cooperative Vermont Cooperative Fire Insurance Company over here at Middlebury. And I was put on that in 1945, and I've been a director of that since.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm one of the oldest directors there. I can't say as I go along sometimes with these modern ideas. I'm a typical Vermonter. I've always said that Vermont was a good state till about 1950, and then when all the flatlanders come up here, they changed everything all around. And I'm one that's very independent. The fact is that I believe that if you own a piece of property, that you have the right to do what you want with it. I'll go along with maybe some regulations, but I think things are just going a little too far. And in fact, I'm negotiating now with my niece, and we're running into all kinds of problems now. So I don't know how it'll come out with us because of so much state regulations. I think this has kind of been very, very difficult for Vermonters because they have been so independent, and we've always felt that one owned a piece of property, it was their property to do whatever they wanted to do with it, and as long as it didn't interfere with too much with the neighbors. And usually neighbors were always very good. If you made a deal with a neighbor, you shook hands, and that was the deal. Nothing had to be written down very much. If a deed was ever made out, it was always usually made out in the town clerk's office, and you didn't have to go to some lawyers or something like that. So many Vermonters underneath are rather sore. But as I've always told many of them, I says, well, you want to remember you're in about in the same position that the Indians used to be. I says, white man come here, took the land away from them. I says, there was only one person that really paid for the land, and that was William Penn down in Pennsylvania. And I says, the rest of the time, I says, the white man's grabbed the land, and I says, they never lived up to a treaty at any time. Some of them think maybe St. Francis up here, who's the chief of the Abenakis, they may think he's a kind of a kook. But on the other hand, I have a lot of respect for him. Maybe he's a little bit ignorant. Maybe we all are a little ignorant. But underneath, we had very good morals. And years ago, we never thought of a murder here in the state. If it was, it might be one, maybe in 2 or 3 years or something like that. Things have changed drastically. And I expect probably the reason it would, due to the fact that so many people have come up here that have money. And usually when there's people that have money, well, then you bring in the other trash. But it comes, as I say, most of them, it's very, very difficult. For them, because they have been very, very independent. Better shut it off again for the time being. I remember my father years ago, of course, he graduated from the Montpelier Seminary, and then he went to business college over in Albany in New York. So he had a pretty good education for that time. But one particular night, I think it was around Halloween night, this fella come up with a load of brick on his wagon. Well, it got late at night, so he unhitched his horses and left the wagon right there by the seminary. And the next morning, the man had his cart, his load of brick, and they were up on the ridge pole of the dormitory. Cart was up there, straddled the ridge pole with all the brick on it. That's one story. And another story years ago. These are all good practical jokes, and they happened. And one particular fellow up here in the valley, he come down, and he was one of these fellows that liked to drink pretty well. And he come down to the one evening down to the village to get some groceries. And so the boys thought they'd have a little fun. So on his wagon, the hind wheels were bigger than the front wheels. So what the boys do, take the hind wheels off the rear and put them on the front and the front on the rear. Well, when the old fella come out of the store, he got into his wagon to go home. And as he went along the road, somebody overheard him. Well, he says, Dolly, he says, when we get up this hill, he says, we'll travel right along. But but in the meantime, he thought he was going uphill all the time. So, but another thing too, to get back to the old life, everybody worked very hard. Most everybody was up at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. They either worked in the mills or they worked on their farm, and they'd work right up until 8 o'clock at night and sometimes longer. And especially when it got sugaring, I can remember myself, I did most of my work, my wife and I, and I'd get up in the morning and milk the cows, and then I'd go and gather some sap during the day, and then I'd come back at night and do the chores, and then I'd go back up to the sugar house, maybe boil until 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. And then, of course, then you had to get up in the morning at 5 or 6 o'clock and do the same thing, chores. And I don't think people realize what it was to work. It didn't hurt anybody. It was a good thing. It kept you out of mischief, especially the younger boys. And usually in high school up here, they'd always have about 3 weeks vacation in the spring of the year so the boys could help their fathers on sugaring and that sort of thing. And then they'd go back to school. As I say, it was a good life, but a hard life. But it never hurt anybody. And we never thought of welfare. Usually, I was overseer of the poor for several years here. And if anybody had trouble and they had to go to the hospital and they didn't have the money, they'd call on the town, you know, for funds. And then it was up to the overseer to have them pay it back and try to find a job for them or something like that. And usually people also helped out by giving food and things like that. And it was a good system because we knew the people. We knew what they could do and to help them out and that sort of thing. And I knew at the time when this welfare business and the government had control of it, that it was going to be an expensive proposition. And it has proven that way. We never thought of any handouts. As I said, if you have trouble, the neighbors tried to help all they could. And sometimes it almost brings tears to you because the change is so different.